study of the energy momentum tensor. And then finally, we will arrive at the Einstein equation. So remember, we defined the energy momentum tensor as that tensor which, for all variations of the metric in a finite region B, with the variation vanishing at the boundary of the region, obeyed this equation here. Remember, lambda was the deformation parameter of the metric, was the variation parameter. So no matter how we vary the metric, the action changes according to this expression here, where T mu nu is the energy momentum tensor. So this definition is meant when we write that the energy momentum tensor is the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric. Up to this prefactor, which, if you remember, we needed in order to make sure that this is a tensor and not a tensor density. Oh. Don't ask again. Very good. Okay. Also, remember that we found that T mu nu obeys this equation. T mu nu, semicolon nu, equal to zero. Always holds. It's not an equation of motion, it's a structural equation, and it arises because of the diffeomorphism invariant of the entire theory. However, remember that this is not a conservation law. Even if, though it looks like it could be a divergence, it is not. And that's because there's this extra index. If T had only one upper index, if it was just one fold contravariant, then this would be a divergence and we would have a conservation law. But we don't. Except we can have a conservation law from this if space-time possesses an isometry. So if there is a so-called Killing vector field that generates a flow which doesn't change the metric. If we flow along that, that vector field, then if the metric doesn't change, so if the Lie derivative of the metric in a direction of that vector field is vanishing, which means that this differential equation holds, that's the same condition as that the Lie derivative of the metric is vanishing. When that's the case, then we showed that P mu defined as the contraction of the energy momentum tensor in the direction of the Killing vector field, we show that this P mu is the divergence that is vanishing, has a divergence that is vanishing. And that meant that we could apply Stokes' theorem, or in this case, it is called the special case of Gauss's theorem. We obtain that a volume integral over region B is the volume integral over divergence, but the divergence is the exterior derivative of the inner derivation of the volume form. And because we have D here, the exterior derivative, we can turn that volume integral into a surface integral by dropping the D, and so we just get the inner derivation of the volume form in the direction of the vector field P, and therefore we have that the total integral over the surface is vanishing, which means that we have as much flowing into the volume as is flowing out of it. Now here's a proposition that we won't prove. The maximal number of independent Killing vector fields that any space-time can possibly have is 10. But intuitively it is because the Lorentz group has 6 parameters, and then we have 4 translations as well. So in Minkowski space, we would have 10, because we have 4 translations, 3 in space, 1 in time. Then we have 3 rotations in space, and we have 3 boosts. So that makes for, in total, a 10-parameter Poincaré group symmetry. And in general, even if it's not Minkowski space, we can also have Killing vector fields. For example, De Sitter space has as many symmetries. So the maximum number in 3 plus 1 dimensions is 10.
Or did you say 2 plus 1? It should be 3 plus 1.
Hmm? 3 plus 1?
You just said 2 plus 1.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I wonder how that happens. And when you definitely think you say 3 plus 1, you say 2 plus 1. you send off a print job, and the print job changes on the way to the printer, right? So anyway, so we still have a kind of Noether theorem here. Killing vector fields are expressing something like a Noether theorem. If you have a symmetry, in this case an isometry, then it comes with a conservation law. And we are used to the fact that time translation invariance leads to energy conservation, space translation invariance to momentum conservation, for example, and then rotation invariance to angular momentum conservation. So let us look at energy conservation for a moment. We define a space-time, or we call a space-time stationary if it has energy conservation. That is to say, a space-time is called stationary if it possesses a Killing vector field which is time-like everywhere. So in other words, a space-time is called stationary, it has energy conservation, if there exists a vector field psi whose lead derivative whose direction the lead derivative of the metric is vanishing, and the length, the invariant length of that vector field, which is also the metric evaluated on those two contravariant vectors, is smaller than zero. In our signature convention, time-like means that the length of a vector is negative. So the metric has the form minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Can always be put into that form. By the way, if this were to come out positive, we would call it space-like, and if it comes out to be equal to zero, then we call it light-like. Anyway, we are interested here in the case of Killing vector fields that are time-like. And that means that the invariant length is negative. Since the vector field is time-like, observers can actually travel along the integral curves of Xi and set up a coordinate system with their eigentime, with their proper time, being the coordinate time. Such coordinate systems are called co-moving coordinate systems. So in such a co-moving coordinate system, the Killing vector field, the time-like Killing vector field, takes this simple form, 1, 0, 0, 0, which is expressing that the coordinate time is the proper time. In such a co-moving coordinate system, the Killing condition, that the lead derivative of the metric in the direction of Xi is vanishing, becomes this equation. Remember, the lead derivative can always be written in this form. I wrote here only commas because we know that that's true from our original definition of the lead derivative long before we introduced an affine connection, long before we introduced the metric. We now know that we can also put semicolons here, but it's also true with just commas. And if you want to put semicolons, put them everywhere. Otherwise, it's not true. You can't just choose, I put a semicolon here and not a semicolon there. You have to either use the definition that we originally used or put semicolons everywhere. So what we have is that this condition then becomes that 0 equal to the g mu nu comma 0. Because you see, these things, these Killing vector fields don't have a dependence on anything anymore, because it's just this vector everywhere. So these guys drop out, and we just have that this is vanishing. In other words, the metric is constant. The metric just doesn't change in time. So to summarize what we have so far, if we have a time-like Killing vector field, then we have not only energy conservation, but also there exists a co-moving coordinate system in which the proper time is the coordinate time, and in which the metric just doesn't change. It might be non-trivial, but it doesn't change in time. It might change in space, but it can't change in time, because the time derivative of the metric is vanishing. So in a static space-time, we can find so-called co-moving coordinate systems such that the time derivative of the metric tensor is vanishing. Now, co-moving observers, that is to say those observers who travel along the flow generated by Xi, see therefore no change in the prevailing local curvature, because the metric tensor just is constant. However, and that may be surprising, stationarity, the fact that the space-time is stationary, the fact that it has a time-like Killing vector field, the fact that there's a coordinate system in which the metric doesn't depend on time, does not mean that the metric can be put into this form. This form being a G00 component, and then some spatial stuff, and nothing on the space-time of diagonals. That's not guaranteed. That's an extra condition to impose if you want it. Just because we have that there's a coordinate system in which the metric doesn't change in time doesn't mean that there have to be zeros here. There could be non-zero terms here. They just are not allowed to depend on time, but they can be non-zero times here. So non-zero terms here. And an example is this. Imagine a rotating black hole. You may know already that there's a so-called Kerr solution for rotating black holes. And such a rotating black hole has a fixed metric. You can look at an eternally spinning rotating black hole. And such a solution has a metric that in a suitable coordinate system doesn't depend on time, clearly, because it's just eternally the same spinning black hole. But when you write down the metric, you find that you cannot put it in this form. No matter what coordinate system you choose, there's always going to be something here on those off diagonals. So that means that a Kerr black hole solution is stationary, but not of that form.
But I thought the definition of stationary was having a time-like Killing vector everywhere. Inside the ergo region, doesn't it change to being space-like? I mean, isn't that the way you define the ergo region to begin with?
Yeah, you see, let's consider, for example, a Schwarzschild black hole. There it is true that the radial variable becomes time-like inside the Schwarzschild radius. I have to think about it. I'm not sure. For the outside, I'm sure, but I'm not sure what happens inside. So what I'm saying is true for observers outside, at least. Since a stationary space-time doesn't have to have that particular simple shape of the metric, we give a name to those space-times where the metric can actually be put into this form, where it's not just stationary, but where the metric can also be in the form where it doesn't have off-diagonal space-time terms. So a space-time is called static if it is not only stationary, so not only does it have a time-like Killing vector field, but also a certain technical condition is supposed to hold, namely that the time-like Killing vector field has to obey the condition also that if we view it as a one form, so we pull down the index using the metric, then it becomes a covariant field, which we can view as a one form, then that one form has to have a wedge product with its D, which is a two form, which is vanishing. I leave it to you as an exercise to write out exactly what that is in coordinates. The significance is that one can prove that if a stationary space-time has a Killing vector field that obeys this additional condition, then the metric can be put into this form, and vice versa. It's also true that if and only if it is of this form, then its Killing vector field obeys that condition.
I have a question. But this Frobenius condition,
is essentially saying that your killing vector is hypersurface orthogonal, right? But does that mean that you can only foliate static spacetimes?
That you can only foliate static spacetimes. No, I don't think it means that. No. You can foliate much more generally than that. Yeah, that's right. No, this is an additional condition to stationary spacetimes, right? So you have a spacetime that's already stationary, but you require something on top of that. And then that's this condition on top of it.
Yeah, but I thought this statement that this extra condition is the fact that killing vectors is perpendicular to every hypersurface that you slice the spacetime. Like if you cut it in, like you can parametrize it into a hypersurfaces that is parametrized by the killing vector.
Mm-hmm.
And this statement is saying that your killing vector field is orthogonal to every space-like hypersurface you do.
You know, let's come back to that later, because I have a later lecture prepared where we will discuss the when you can put spacetimes, when you can slice them into space-like hypersurfaces, which has to do with when you can define a global clock and things like that. Okay, so that's one thing I wanted to mention, namely that there is a difference between stationary spacetimes, which are spacetimes when there's energy conservation, and static spacetimes, where in addition to energy conservation, you also have that the metric takes this nice block diagonal form. Now, there's something else we need to clarify before we can move on to the Einstein equation. Namely, some generic properties of the energy momentum tensor. We defined the energy momentum tensor as the functional derivative of the action of the matter fields with respect to the metric, up to prefactor 1 over square root of g. But that didn't tell us exactly how the energy momentum tensor looks like in practice. I showed you some examples for the electromagnetic field and for Klein-Gordon field. But generally, there can be lots of contributions to the energy momentum tensor. Every field in the standard model contributes to the energy momentum tensor. But that's just a small part. It's just like 5% of what contributes to the energy momentum tensor, because there's also dark matter in the universe. And we don't really know what it's made of. And then there is dark energy as well. And they contribute the remaining 95% or so. They all contribute to the energy momentum tensor. Now, for a Klein-Gordon field or the electromagnetic field, we can calculate what the properties are of their contributions to the energy momentum tensor. But for the other stuff, dark matter and dark energy, we don't really know. Well, for dark energy, we have a good idea. Dark energy is basically a contribution to the energy momentum tensor, which is proportional to the metric. But for dark matter, we really don't know. But that's a problem, because if we want to solve later on for the dynamics of space-time, it will be governed by the energy momentum tensor and its properties. So it is often useful to make some assumptions in the absence of complete knowledge of what T mean U is. So we will make an assumption of the kind that, well, T mean U, whatever it is actually, concretely, it will have the property so-and-so, or it will have property so-and-so, if it can be argued reasonably that it should have these properties. And that helps us then derive things. For example, there's the question of whether black holes are unavoidable as a consequence of general relativity, or whether they are rare or even impossible to form. I mean, for example, you could imagine that you have matter arranged in some distributed way, and then gravitationally it starts accelerating towards each other, all these different contributions of the matter, and eventually you might say, oh, all right, the density gets higher and higher. Eventually, it will disappear behind its Schwarzschild horizon, and it becomes a black hole. Or will it? You see, in the late 60s, early 70s, the question was, is that really necessarily happening? Because imagine what happens when, for example, a figure skater is on the ice and is spinning a little bit and then pulling her arms in. She will spin very, very fast. And there will be a lot of forces that will tend to rip her arms out again, right? Because she's spinning so fast, angular momentum conservation. So similarly, you could imagine that black holes don't really form, because if stuff collapses inwards and has a bit of angular momentum to start with, then it just might start spinning like crazy and eventually, you know, it might just go in and then out again. So singularity theorems were developed that showed that actually black hole singularities and the formation of horizons is kind of unavoidable. It cannot be prevented by things like this figure skating effect. But in order to make such, to do such proofs, you have to make statements about the matter content, about the stuff that's in falling there, without knowing exactly what it is and how it contributes to gravity, that is to say, how it contributes to the energy momentum tensor. So for those singularity theorems that we will later cover, assumptions need to be made about the energy momentum tensor. And here are some of these assumptions that are often made, and that are then often used, for example, for singularity theorems and other purposes. The first assumption is the so-called weak energy condition. And it's really just an assumption. We don't know whether it is actually obeyed. And in fact, there are indications that in quantum field theory, you can go around it. But let's see. There are good arguments to assume that it might hold in many circumstances. So the weak energy condition is this. It says that for all time-like vectors V, or vector fields V, so you remember that means the length is negative, we want that the contraction of the energy momentum tensor with this vector, left and right, is larger than zero. Why would we want to assume that? Why should that be true, given dark energy, given dark matter, given everything else that we know? Why would we expect this to be true? Well, an actual observer, an actual astronaut, or us being astronauts on Earth, always travel with a time-like tangent vector. We can't move space-like, that would be acosal. And we can't move time-like, that's too fast. Light-like, that would be too fast, it would be speed of light. So what this means is that if we were to travel with a velocity vector v, that's time-like, and we choose a coordinate system that's co-moving, then what we see as the energy is the zero-zero component of t, because in the co-moving frame, v is just 1, 0, 0, 0, and therefore we pick out that, it's the energy density. And so this is the claim that the energy density should be positive for all traveling observers. Or, I mean, traveling, you might as well just be traveling through time and sitting fixed in space. Further, there is the so-called dominant energy condition. So the dominant energy condition says that, assume that the weak energy condition is obeyed. So we have that this contraction t mu, v nu is larger or equal to zero for all time like v, so all observers see positive energy density. But also, in addition to that, we require that this vector that you obtain by contracting your velocity vector with t mu nu obeys that its length is negative. Why would we want to assume that? Remember that if v is a killing vector field, then t mu nu v nu is that vector field p mu, of which we know that the divergence vanishes, so we have a conservation law. So this expression is the flow of energy and momentum in cases of killing vector fields where they are conserved. But we can define k mu, we can define this flow no matter what, even if there isn't a killing vector field, even if v is not a killing vector field, we can still define the k mu. And to require that the length of this vector field is smaller than equal to zero means that this flow whether it's conserved or not, we want it to be time-like, which is to say that energy and momentum may not be conserved, but at least they should only flow into the future. They should not flow space-like. They should flow in a causal way. So that's the dominant energy condition. And in an orthonormal basis, it means that T naught naught is larger or equal to TAB, the modulus of TAB, as you can show in a little exercise. All of this makes sense from a fluid mechanics perspective. If the universe was always just filled by a fluid, if dark matter was some kind of fluid, like water, and everything else is just some kind of fluid, then that would make sense. But for quantum fields, things are different. And there's entanglement and all sorts of non-local effects. You can have non-local coherence, non-local entanglement. And it's not clear that these statements really apply in the case of quantum field theory, that these assumptions necessarily apply. There could be exceptions.
How does that apply to dark matter? Because you make the T00 bigger than the modulus of something, so you can't support negative energy density, which is usually what you do for cold dark matter.
No, wait. The energy density you always want to have positive. It's for the pressure of dark energy that you would want to have a negative.
Oh, right.
Okay. So let's look at the, finally, after having studied things to do with the energy momentum tensor, we are ready to do the Einstein equation. You see, the energy momentum tensor is super important because it is what makes space curved. So now that we've done that, we can study the dynamics of the curvature of space. Now, in principle, I could just dump the Einstein equation here and just say, this is it, or the action. I could just give you the Einstein action and say, well, that's what Einstein found, let's believe it. But it turns out that there's a more modern view of these things. It turns out that Einstein really had no choice. And that was discovered by Andrei Sakharov sometime in the 60s. And he wrote a remarkable paper, barely half a page long. It's really very much worth seeing. It was translated from the Russian into English, and it's available for free now. Quite remarkable. And where he pointed out that Einstein gravity is unavoidable. It comes from quantum field theory. Given quantum field theory, and given the possibility that space-time might be curved, it must obey the Einstein equation. It must be governed by the Einstein action, and also we must have corrections to it. And those corrections are probably very small. So I'd like to show you that entire argument there. Let's begin with the full matter action. So this is the action that contains all the terms in the standard model, and in principle, one day we find out what the dark matter is, and its terms also go into this. At the moment, you should think of them as being there, but we don't know exactly what shape they take. So we take the full matter action. It depends on the fields, and I just write psi, but psi stands here for all kinds of fields, electrons, quarks, gluons, and neutrinos, the whole thing, the whole zoo. And here's the metric. So we have that matter fields live on the background of a curved spacetime described by a metric G. Here we have the Lagrangian, which is a scalar function, and here we have the measure, so the whole thing here is a four-form. The equations of motion, and Jason told you all about this, the equations of motion for matter fields can be obtained by these are the classical equations of motion, by requiring that when you differentiate the matter action, so the action of all matter fields, and for cosmologists, matter includes light, just to clarify the terminology. And also everything that's not hydrogen is called a metal. So it's
helium.
And helium, yeah, hydrogen and helium. Everything heavier than helium is a metal. And everything that's not gravity is matter. It's just the terminology. So the equations of motion for matter fields, which includes electromagnetism and gluon fields, which are massless, are given by the variation of the action with respect to the matter fields and setting that equal to zero. And that translates into Euler Lagrange equations of the usual kind, dl by d psi equal to, and then derivative of the functional derivative of L with respect to the covariant derivative of the matter fields. So for every matter field component, we have an Euler Lagrange equation. Every matter field component gets its own derivative set equal to zero. Now, what about the metric? You see, the matter action depends on all the matter fields, electromagnetism, quarks, and the whole thing. It depends on all of them, but also the metric. We said that we obtain the equations of motion for the matter fields simply by functional differentiating with respect to the matter field, setting it equal to zero, bang, we get the Euler Lagrange equation of the equation of motion. But the action also depends on the metric. So shouldn't we just differentiate with respect to the metric and then expect that we get the Einstein equation, right? So we functional differentiate the action of all matter fields with respect to the metric, set that equal to zero, and is it the equation of motion for gravity? Well, apparently not. You see, what would we get? We already calculated what the functional derivative is of all the matter fields with respect to the metric. It is up to a prefactor of 1/2 and square root of g. It's the energy momentum tensor. So if we just say that the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric is vanishing, we are really just saying that the energy momentum tensor should vanish. That can't be right. That can't be right. So the universe would have to be empty if this was all there is, assuming that all matter contributes positively. But then Andrei Sakharov, who, by the way, invented the Russian hydrogen bomb, but then still fell out with the Russian overlords and was sent to Siberia for it. Anyway, he was a very clever fellow, and he understood first that the quantum effects of matter induce extra terms in the action. So far, the action that we considered was just the action of the matter field. But because of quantum effects, there will be extra terms in the action, and those extra terms are an infinite sequence of extra terms, most of which are super tiny, but the first ones are the ones that give us Einstein gravity. So this argument is called induced gravity, and that's what we will study now. So what it also means is that if Einstein had never lived, and well, special relativity would have been found pretty quickly, that's quite sure. It didn't depend on Einstein to find it. But general relativity might have taken some more decades to be discovered. And the latest, Sakharov would have found it. Because his argument says that if you have quantum fields living on a space-time that could be curved, then the dynamics of that curvature has to be governed by the Einstein equations to some very good approximation, and there have to be correction terms to it as well. So here's Sakharov's reasoning. It's a modernized version. It's not exactly the way he put it in the 60s. So classical deterministic The classical deterministic evolution of matter, electrons, photons, and so on, obeys this variational principle. But quantum theory is not restricted to this. In quantum theory, every evolution that is conceivable, every evolution that you can write down, has a probability amplitude for actually happening. This is the Feynman path integral view of quantum theory. So the classical action principle says that the classical evolution that degrees of freedom take, be they first or second quantized, I mean, be they just individual particles or fields, the classical action principle says that the actual evolution that is being undertaken by a classical system is an evolution which extremizes the action. So if the evolution were somewhat different, the action would be different. But it has to be extremer. That's the classical view. But Feynman says, and this goes back to an idea of Dirac that Feynman only worked out, as Feynman acknowledges himself. So quantum theory allows every evolution to happen, every evolution psi of x and t, for all fields I, happen virtually, which is to say, as long as you don't observe between two measurements, any evolution can happen. And the probability amplitude, whose modulus square would be the probability amplitude for a particular evolution to have taken place is given by a normalization constant times e to the power of I times the action for that particular evolution of the field divided by h bar. So every possible conceivable evolution of the fields is virtually taken with the probability amplitude given by this. And then you can do statistical mechanics. Just like for ordinary probabilities and ordinary statistics, but you have to work with probability amplitudes. If you're not familiar with the path integral formulation of quantum theory, then I very, very much recommend reading the first few pages, maybe the first 30 pages or so, of the textbook by Feynman and Hibbs, Quantum Mechanics and Path Integral. It's just ingenious. It's ingenious how Feynman explains this business, and his point is that ordinary probability theory still applies in quantum mechanics, except that instead of probabilities that have values between 0 and 1 and are real numbers, you have probability amplitudes, which are complex numbers. And then, for example, when you have two alternative possibilities, an electron can go through this hole or it can go through that hole, classical probability theory would say the probability that it goes through any one of those two holes is the probability that it goes through the first one plus the probability that it goes through the second one. Feynman explains that in quantum theory, you have a probability amplitude for it to go through the first hole and a probability amplitude for it to go through the second hole. These are complex numbers. And the total probability amplitude that it goes through any one of those two holes, that it goes through at all, is the sum of these two probability amplitudes. And similarly, if one event is the condition for a second event to be able to happen, then classical probability theory would say, well, you have the probability that A happens, and then conditioning when A happened, maybe B happens with probability, second probability, then the total probability that both of these things happen, first A and then B, is the product of the two probabilities, the probability that A happened and the probability that, given A, B also happened. Feynman explained that in quantum theory, you again multiply, but you don't multiply probabilities, you multiply probability amplitudes. And when do we have to use ordinary probability theory? And when do we have to use ordinary, when do we have to use the quantum mechanical probability amplitudes theory? Well, it depends on whether you observe the processes or not. If you do observe the processes, if you measure them, while you measure them, ordinary statistics apply. And if you don't measure them, if you leave things on their own for a while, then what happens is that you have to work with probability amplitudes. Eventually, when you do measure probability amplitudes, you have to take, when you do measure something, then you have to take the probability amplitude that you calculated, take the modulus squared, that's the probability for measuring the predicted thing. Anyway, I hope you have heard about these things. If not, please catch up. Read Feynman and Hibbs. Anyway, so Zaharov continued by saying, look, there's a probability amplitude for all sorts of things to happen. And actually, he said nothing of the kind in his half-page paper, but that's the philosophy behind it all. And what this means is that, as usual in quantum theory, the actual matter evolution is not exactly as described by classical mechanics. You see, sometimes the quantum expectation value obeys the same equation of motion as the classical equations of motion. That's true for the harmonic oscillator, for example. But it's a very rare exception. Usually, when the potential is a little bit more complicated than that of a harmonic oscillator, then the quantum evolution is different from the classical evolution. The quantum expectation value behaves differently. Now, you can account for that. You can account for that by putting extra terms into the action, or into the Hamiltonian, or the Lagrangian. You can put extra terms there which correct for that, which correct for the effect of the fields exploring not just the extremal action paths, but also the paths around. And what you then get is the so-called effective action. So the quantum expectation values do generally not obey the classical equations of motion. No, the quantum expectation values generally obey classical equations of motion with modified actions, modified Lagrangians, modified Hamiltonians. And that's the key. See, Sakharov said, let's do that. Let us look at quantum fields that live not on Minkowski space, but quantum fields that live on a curved space-time. And then let's ask, the quantum evolution of these matter fields is impacted by the quantum effects on the curved space-time. And he said, how is it impacted? What kind of terms do I have to add to the action, or to the Hamiltonian, or to the Lagrangian? What kind of terms do I have to add in order to account for the fact that I don't get the classical motion for my expectation values? No, I get a quantum modified motion. I get a quantum effective action, a quantum effective Hamiltonian. So the quantum fields of the Steinert model actually obey equations of motion that are somewhat modified. So what happens is this. You take the standard model action. And if you've ever seen the standard model action, you know it fills a page because we have so many particles there. And let's say you study that in Minkowski space to start with. Then you ask what Sakharov asked, namely, how is the motion affected of the expectation values of your fields because they are not evolving classically, but because they're evolving quantumly? It turns out that that gives you extra terms that you have to add to the action. And you may wonder, well, what? I get even more pages of stuff then? I start with one page and then I do these calculations, let's say to first order quantum effect, and suddenly I get many more terms. Well, it turns out that the standard model of particle physics is a renormalizable theory, and that means that, luckily, those extra terms are of the same form as all the terms that were already there. So those extra terms just change the prefactors in front of the terms that we had, because we get new terms there, but it just changes the prefactors. So the standard model is stable in that regard. However, if you calculate the same thing, if you calculate the impact of quantum effects for a quantum field that lives on a curved space-time, then two things happen. First, you again get terms that are so-called counterterms from the renormalization. You get terms that are of the same form as the standard model terms that were already there. That's fine. We know all that already. But you also get many more terms because there's a new player in the game, which is the metric and the curvature. And Sakharov's ingenious observation was that the first few of those terms are the Einstein action. So the problem here is that these calculations are in practice very difficult. But it can be done perturbatively. And Still, it is super difficult to do. However, one thing is clear, and that's why Sakharov's paper was able to be just half a page long. The thing that is clear is that these counterterms, these extra terms that express the deviation from classical motion, the quantum effective action terms, those terms have to respect the symmetries that are inherent in the problem. They couldn't just be anything. They have to be of the right tensorial structure. I'm cheating a little bit because it turns out that the quantization of a classical theory with a symmetry can break that symmetry. This is a phenomenon called anomaly, but it would take us away from the subject of our course. So generally, the symmetries present in the theory will be conserved, and that means that these so-called counterterms that arise from the quantization, that arise from the fact that the evolution is not just governed by the extremal action case, but the evolutions explore all paths, not just the extremal ones, and therefore explore the potential, for example, at values that the classical field would never explore, and therefore the field will be impacted by that on average. So the phenomenon that Sakharov relied on is that all these extra terms, all these quantum effects should respect the symmetries. Okay, I think I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. So in practice, if you do these calculations, so perturbative quantum field theory, then there occur integrals that are divergent because of the behavior of the integrand at very short distances or at very high energies and very high momenta. You for sure have heard about this. These are so-called ultraviolet divergencies. So our quantum field theories are generally ill-behaved in what is called the ultraviolet. They are ill-behaved at very small distances, at very large momenta, very large energies. Therefore, it is necessary, in order to make sense of the calculations, to introduce a cutoff and not to perform these integrals down to arbitrarily small distances. Not to perform these integrals, if we work in Fourier space, to arbitrarily high momenta, arbitrarily high energies, because they would be divergent. In practice, therefore, a length scale is introduced, let's call it LC, C for cutoff, or usually called the regularization. A length scale is introduced, or if you take h bar divided by LC, then it's a momentum scale, and then you cut your integrals at those scales. You either just cut them, or there are other tricks like changing dimension and various other things, but there's always a length scale at which you say that you don't trust your calculations anymore, and therefore we cut off our integrals in the quantum field theory. We don't believe that the quantum field theory description is even accurate for length scales beyond that. And, of course, that length scale is generally assumed to exist. It's generally assumed to exist that at sufficiently small length scales, 10 to the minus 35 meters, the Planck scale, quantum field theory really does break down, and therefore these integrals really don't make any sense. But particle physicists who make predictions for collisions at CERN, for example, for practical purposes, don't view it this way. They would say, well, to hell with the Planck scale, we can't measure that anyway, because they're 15 orders of magnitude away from measuring Planck scale physics. So particle physicists traditionally have introduced a length scale LC by hand in order to make those calculations finite, but have found it convenient to then calculate predictions and even let this LC scale go to zero later on. You can do this. There's a procedure called renormalization, where you hold predictions fixed as finite, and then you let this go down all the way to zero, just to get clean formulas. You really don't have to make the limit for LC going to zero. If you keep LC at 10 to the minus 35 meters, you get, for all practical purposes, the exact same predictions as if you let it go to zero mathematically. But the point is that for mathematical convenience, for predictions for the LHC, you may want to let this run to zero in a very carefully controlled data way. So just you get fewer terms, because some terms then go to zero. But what we really believe is happening is that there is indeed a length scale, the Planck scale, at which those integrals are truncated. Now, once we've done that, once we've cut off the infinite integrals that arise in quantum field theory, we remember then what Sakharov said. He said that in quantum theory, the effective action, remember the effective action, contains all those extra terms that describe how the motion has changed compared to the classical action, how the motion has changed because of quantum effect. Sakharov pointed out that in quantum theory, and that should be the case in quantum field theory as well, the effective action will contain terms of all possible forms as long as they are consistent with the symmetries of the theory. And in this case here, as long as they are consistent with the general covariance of the theory. By symmetries, I don't mean here isometries, killing vector fields. We know that in nature there are no killing vector fields. No, it's the diffeomorphism invariance. So the counterterms that will arise in quantum field theory should be expected to be all terms that are allowed by the theory without breaking the covariance. So what this means is that the effective action that you obtain for a quantum field theory of all matter fields, psi, on the background of a classical metric, the effective action should have this form. And that equation you find in Sakharov's paper. So it has this form. There is the original matter action, the one-page formula from the textbooks on the standard model, plus correction terms to that. But remember, they are of the same form as that, just renormalizing the prefactors, plus all those terms that are allowed by the symmetries of the theory, that is to say that are allowed by the covariance structure of the theory. In particular, there could be a term that is just a constant here, because a constant times square root of g d4x is a volume form. It's perfectly covariantly possible to have a constant here. Also, there could be a constant times the Ricci scalar. Perfectly possible. It's just a scalar here multiplied with this volume form. That's a term that can arise. And there could be higher order terms in the curvature and in the field. So these terms arise because our matter fields live on a curved space-time. You may wonder, really? Is there any example for this? Fortunately, there are plenty of examples for this. If you take a crystal, say a quartz, a piece of quartz, then you have phonons in there. And you have all kinds of other composite degrees of freedom and pseudo degrees of freedom. And they obey wave equations. Now, if you take that crystal and you deform it by bending it, by pressing it, by shearing it, then in effect, you're implementing curvature in that crystal. In fact, you can even arrange to have torsion in that crystal, which is when you have that, if you go around a plane, you go all the way around, you may not end up on the same plane again. You may have gone up like in the spiral staircase. So if you take a crystal and you deform it, you are in effect putting curvature in it. And that means that the equations of motion, for example, for the phonons, are modified because of that. The phonons propagate a little differently. And in fact, you get terms just like these for the matter fields for, I mean, in this case, in the case of a crystal, for phonon fields. So these terms have an energetic impact. I mean, not just an energetic impact, also for momentum, for everything, right? But in particular, they have an energetic impact. In fact, that energetic impact, in the case of the crystal, is the back driving force that resists the bending of the crystal. It's exactly these extra terms that you get there. You deform the crystal, and that costs you energy to do. It's in these extra terms that that arises. So in space-time, you should expect the same thing. And in fact, if you do the calculations, if you do perturbative quantum field theory for matter fields, just the ordinary standard model, but on a curved background, the curvature is not quantized, right? It's just a classical metric. If you do these calculations on the curved background, you do indeed get these old terms plus extra terms of that form. You can calculate them now. Sahov didn't, but he knew that they could be calculated, that they would arise. Now, what Sahov didn't calculate is these coefficients, C1, C2, C3, and so on. There's a lot of hard work in calculating these guys. Because you would actually have to calculate all the Feynman graphs and renormalize them and see how the metric enters in them and so on. But Sahov was able to make some general considerations about these coefficients. So the constants C1 and C2 depend on various things. They depend on the details of the matter action. Bosons and fermions, for example, tend to contribute to C1 in opposite ways. It turns out that boson fields tend to contribute positively to this. Fermion fields tend to contribute negative to this. If nature had supersymmetry, and the current experimental evidence is that we don't, but if we had exact supersymmetry, then for every boson field, there would be a fermion field and vice versa. And it would turn out that the C1 is zero exactly. But we don't have supersymmetry, and C1 is not zero. So the constant C1 and C2 depend on our perturbation calculation. And of course, these constants depend on the value of our short distance cutoff. Because remember that without the cutoff, these things would come out infinite. The C1, C2, C3, they would come out infinite. Or zero, but in any case, not a finite value. So Sahov made this simple argument here, namely that C1, this constant, after a lot of work, a lot of calculation, has to come out to be proportional to the cutoff length to the fourth power, 1 over the cutoff length to the fourth power. And why is that? Well, it's because let us look at how C1 arises in here. C1 is multiplied with this. Now, the metric doesn't have units, but this has units of length to the fourth power. But that means that this must have units of 1 over length to the fourth power. And similarly, you can argue that C2, because it must have units of 1 over length squared, will have to come out to be proportional to this value. C3 would be proportional to the cutoff to the zeroth power. That one would be proportional to cutoff squared. With prefactors whose calculation we would have to carry out, and that's where a lot of work is in there. We don't know beforehand exactly what the values of lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3 are. If you work with a particular matter field, such as a Klein-Gordon field, then you can calculate what this would be. But in practice, that's not very useful, because we know that the matter action has dozens of different of species of fields in it. And we would really have to do it for all species in order to get this one number here, that one number there. And it's especially hopeless because most of the matter, we don't even know what its action is. It's dark matter. So we can't really calculate those coefficients. However, Sahov made the very good argument that these coefficients should be, roughly speaking, of order 1. That doesn't exclude that some of them might be 0.2 or some of them might be 27, but roughly of order 1. The argument is basically this. Imagine you're given a calculation of the kind that you had in primary school, where you're told that a farmer has so many cows and they produce on average so much milk per day, and then he goes to the market and he sells them for so many bucks per liter, and then you're supposed to calculate how much profit that farmer makes. Now, without doing the calculation, you know that the answer is not $10 quadrillion. You don't have to do that, right? Because you know what goes into it roughly shapes what can come out of it. And so similarly, since we don't have super extreme numbers going into those calculations, like the fine structure constant is 1 over 137, it's not extreme, right? And so generally in the standard model, we don't have extreme numbers, so we don't expect extreme numbers to come out, roughly speaking. So these numbers are to be of order 1. So now, for small cutoff lengths, like 10 to the minus 35 meters, the Planck length, we therefore have that, given that these are assumed to be of order 1, roughly, we have that C1 is way larger than C2, way larger than C3, way larger than C4, and so on. See, because this is, LC is a very small number, 10 to the minus 35 meters. So to the fourth power, that's super small. We take 1 over it, so that becomes super large. So C1 is super large. C2 only goes with this power, it's still large, but not as large as this, and so on, right? So you have this hierarchy here of constants. So Saharov said that, therefore, in the induced action, we have the following. We have that the quantum effective action that takes into account the quantum effects that operate on psi, where we have not quantized gravity. G is just a classical background at this stage. We don't quantize G, the metric. We don't even know its evolution just yet. We just assume we have a background metric. Then Zaharov says that this quantum effective action is the old action with renormalized coefficients plus C1 plus a C2R, and the other terms are relatively small compared to those guys. And then he postulates that, the equations of motion of the metric follow from this now completed action principle, where we have both the matter action given by the matter Lagrangian plus these two leading terms. So we're not saying that the functional derivative of just the matter action with respect to the metric is equal to 0, because that would simply mean that the energy momentum tensor has to vanish. No, what we're now saying is that the functional derivative of the entire effective action, which is being generated by the quantum fluctuations of the quantum field, that entire action should have the property that if varied with respect to g is equal to 0. So the classical equation of motion for the classical metric should take this form, because the matter fields are really quantized, and therefore the action that they obey is not really just the action that we write down initially, like the standard model action from the textbook, but it will pick up extra terms that renormalize the coefficients in a well-known way, but also these terms. It's unavoidable. We know that this sort of thing happens for crystals. It would be a miracle if it didn't happen for space-time as well. But this is actually the Einstein action, the Einstein-Hilbert action. Einstein postulated the exact same thing, namely that the equations of motion, the thing that's later called the Einstein equation, is given by varying this effective action with respect to the metric and setting that equal to 0. Only Einstein didn't know where these coefficients would come from. If you want to know more about this induced gravity business from Sakharov, see, for example, this review. It's a very good review. Okay, so now we arrived at the Einstein action, and we need to derive the Einstein equation from it. So we calculate the derivative of the complete effective action with respect to the metric. Part of it we can carry out immediately, because we know what the derivative of the matter part with respect to the metric is. That's the energy momentum tensor. We did this already. It turns out that if we differentiate the effective action with respect to the metric, if we differentiate the remaining part, namely the part proportional to C1 and the part proportional to C2, so just the constant part and the part that is proportional to R, if we differentiate those two parts with respect to the metric, then we get the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. And that's what we will calculate now. By the way, you may wonder, this is a constant. Why does it give us a contribution when we vary with respect to the metric? Well, it's a constant multiplied with the square root of g. That's why this thing also gives us a contribution.
I got one slide later. So the t mu nu is coming from the Lagrangian full metric field, right?
Yeah.
But how about the quantum correction of the Lagrangian? Normalized.
Yeah. That's assumed in here. So remember, I wrote here L is a total effective matter Lagrangian. So in principle, you have to do all the quantum fluctuations of this.
All right, so it's,
and it just renormalizes the terms in there, and then you get a renormalized energy momentum tensor. That's what you get.
Okay.
Yeah. And it arises in this equation here on the right-hand side with a minus sign, because it really arises on the left-hand side, right? It's equal to zero, but I've put it on the other side, so we have a minus sign over here. Okay. So there are two things to do now. One is we have to calculate what the left-hand side is. So we have to functionally differentiate those two terms. Remember, this is the Ricci scalar. I just spelled it out, R mu nu times G mu nu. You have to functionally differentiate these two terms with respect to the metric, and that will give us the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. And secondly, we will have to find out what the coefficients C1 and C2 are. Now, given the timing, okay, well, let's see how things proceed. So let's at least do part of this functional derivative of these two terms. You see, there are several things to do. We need to functionally differentiate the term C1 times the square root of g. We'll have to functionally differentiate the term R mu nu times square root of g, which is two terms, really, because we differentiate with respect to its dependence on the metric. And by the Leibniz rule, that dependence on the metric. And then we also have this term times that. You know, I mean, there's lots of Leibniz rule, lots of terms to calculate. Maybe let's just do a few of them, and then skip the details of the calculation and move on to the discussion of C1 and C2, what values they have. So let's calculate the left-hand side. First thing we need to do is to vary, that is to say, to functionally differentiate this term, the C1 term, which is a constant, but it's still multiplied with square root of g. So we need to functionally differentiate this term with respect to the metric. So what is it? Well, we have to differentiate the square root of g with respect to the metric, multiply that with the variation of the metric. Remember, we had this before when we calculated the energy momentum tensor. So this functional derivative is this term. So we carry that forward, we get that. Okay, so we already have the contribution of the C1 term to the Einstein equation on the left-hand side. Secondly, we have this term to functionally differentiate. That was the term C2 times the Ricci scalar, times the square root of g d4x. Okay, so there are two terms here. By the Leibniz rule, we have to functionally differentiate the R mu nu with respect to the metric, leaving that the same, plus leaving the R mu nu the same, and functionally differentiate that piece here. Okay, proposition is, the first term here, this whole business is vanishing. Right. So to see this, let us choose the origin of a geodesic coordinate system. The Ricci tensor takes this form in every coordinate system, But these terms are absent at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, because at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, the Christoffel symbols vanish. Not the derivatives of the Christoffel symbols, but the Christoffel symbols themselves vanish at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system. And that means that the variation of the Ricci tensor with respect to the metric is given by the variation of these two terms. Here they are. So, the term g mu nu times delta r mu nu, that is one of the terms that we have to work out up here. This the delta r mu nu times g mu nu. Delta r mu nu times g mu nu is therefore given by these two terms here. And if you look at this closely, you will find that these two terms can be written as w alpha comma alpha, where w is this vector here. You just have to rename here the alpha as nu and the nu is alpha, and then you see that the two terms that you get by differentiating this vector with respect to alpha, this term is this one, and that term is that one. So we have this term here, this w term. We have that g mu nu delta r mu nu is equal to this at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system. But at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, and now I'm using a trick we've used many times before, at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, Christoffel symbols vanish. So I might as well add the Christoffel symbol here and make this a semicolon. Okay, because the Christoffel symbol doesn't contribute. So this equation is also true with a semicolon here. But if it is true with a semicolon here, the whole thing is covariant and therefore no longer tied to this being at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, and therefore in any coordinate system, we have that this equation holds true. All right? But it turns out that when we calculate this, it is this, and that is, of course, a divergence. Right? This is a divergence, and therefore we have that we can use Stokes, or really Gauss's theorem in this case here, and we obtain a surface integral, but our variation is over a finite region and no variation at the boundary. And so that term disappears the same way that it did previously for the calculation of the energy momentum tensors property that t mu nu semicolon nu summed over all nu is vanishing. All right. Now we need to evaluate term two. So we had that term with the delta on the r and that one not differentiated. Now, by the Leibniz rule, we have not differentiated this one, but we are going to differentiate that one. So if you go through all of these motions here, and I think, if I remember correctly, there are no new tricks in this. So let me just show you then what we get. If we do this differentiation, we don't get that it vanishes. Instead, what we obtain is that the contribution of this term, this variation, and that's really all there is, because the other term vanished, as we just showed, because of Gauss's theorem. What we obtain is that the contribution from the variation of that term with respect to the metric is given by this expression here, where this particular combination arises, RAB minus 1 half GABR. That combination of curvature terms is super important and it is called the Einstein tensor because of that. So now if we bring together the three calculations ABC that we did for the various terms that arise, we obtain that Sakharov's prediction for the effective action contributions for gravity, functionally differentiated with respect to the metric, and that is what needs to go on the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. So this expression, functionally differentiated with respect to the metric, is given by this term here. And you see here the Einstein tensor multiplied with the coefficient C2, and you see the coefficient C1. So to summarize these things again, we have that the functional derivative with respect to the metric of the Sakharov terms, or really the Einstein-Hilbert action, the constant term C2 times the Ricci scalar and square root of G, functional derivative with respect to G, is given by this. So finally, we can conclude this. If we take the complete action, complete effective action, so it's the action for the standard model fields and dark matter fields, once we know what they are, taking into account the effect of quantum fluctuations, we get extra terms in the action, and we took the leading ones, the C1 and C2 terms. If we take that action and functionally differentiate with respect to the metric and set that equal to zero, in order to obtain the classical equations of motion for the metric, then we obtain this equation here. This is the stuff that we get for the left-hand side of the Einstein equation, and on the right-hand side, we get the energy-momentum tensor. Now, let's divide by the coefficients suitably, and then we get this equation here. If we just divide by square root of g and 1 half and a minus sign and by C2, then we obtain that the Einstein tensor minus this business here is equal to 1 over 2 C2 T mu nu. So that's the Einstein equation, where we haven't fixed the coefficients C1 and C2 yet. So what could they be? But it turns out that in 1918, when general relativity was first discovered, Einstein had this equation. He had this coefficient, which he called the cosmological constant. And he had that coefficient. And he had data about the solar system. And he showed that using that equation, he could predict a small shift in the perihelion of Mercury better than Newton could. And what he had to do in order to do this is to identify the coefficient C2 with 1 over 16 pi g. So this is not governed by the math. It comes out from the physics. The physics tells us that the coefficient C2 has to come out 1 over 16 pi g, which also means that the matter content of everything in the universe, visible matter, dark matter, whatever else there might be, must conspire, or the total, sum total of what it does in terms of producing extra terms in the effective action, the sum total of what it does is to produce a C2 term which has this value. I'm not saying it's a coincidence, it's just that this is what the value is. Where capital G is Newton's constant. So, we arrive now at Einstein's equation. Because we fixed what C2 is. So having fixed C2, we obtain that there's an 8 pi g times the energy momentum tensor on the right-hand side. We have on the left-hand side the Einstein tensor. And we have this business here. Minus 8 pi g C1 times the metric g mu nu. This is really what Einstein called the cosmological constant. Now, what can we say about the cosmological constant? What value does it take? So this whole thing is called lambda. It turns out we can say something about it. And the reason is that we can say something about LC. You see, 1 over 16 pi g has to be equal to C2. This is in order to allow Einstein to predict classical gravity with even more accuracy for effects that go beyond Newtonian gravity. So this is a measured relationship. That's true by measurement. But we also know that C2 is equal to lambda 2 times LC to the power minus 2. Just from Sakharov's very general consideration. But you see, what this means is that since we assume that lambda 2 is of order 1, we can basically tell from C what C2 is, we can tell what LC is. Remember, I argued earlier that LC, the cutoff length, should be the Planck length. And that's because of folklore. People say that the cutoff should be at the Planck length because they do the one or the other calculation where they say that if you try to resolve distances smaller than the Planck length, then you would be creating black holes, or just in general, you have curvature fluctuations that are so strong that they would make it impossible to make measurements of distances that are smaller than the Planck length, and so on. Many arguments lead us to believe that the Planck length is the limit to how far we can push general relativity and quantum field theory. And beyond that, some other quantum gravity theory needs to kick in. But the value of the Planck length is usually derived hand-wavingly. Here's another way to derive it Planck length hand-wavingly, namely, assuming that, and this is the farmer with cows argument, assuming that lambda is of order 1, all the lambdas are of order 1, we see here that because we know the value of C2 to be this, we know what the value of LC to the power minus 2 is. Let's see what it is. Right? We can calculate that now. We can calculate, we can solve that equation for LC. And we find that LC is equal to lambda 2 times the square root of 16 pi g. With lambda 2 being of order 1, this is square root of 16 pi h bar g over c. Just plugging in the h bars and the c's, you see we use units where h bar is equal to 1, c is equal to 1. But plugging them back in is easy because we know that the whole thing must work out to be a length squared, so that the square root of it is a length. Plugging it back in, we get these explicit expressions, we get out the pocket calculator, and we type the numbers in, and we see what we get for LC. It turns out LC has to be L2, length of a number of order 1 by the farmer and cows and milk and market argument, then 4 times square root of pi times this expression here, which is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 35 meters, which is the Planck length. So what we see here is that, to summarize, Sacharov argument shows us that quantum field theory produces the Einstein action, it produces the term with a Ricci scalar in the action, with the correct prefactor C2 to match predictions if you cut off quantum field theory at the Planck length. Right? If you cut off quantum field theory at a smaller or larger scale, then you do get the Einstein action, but not with the right prefactor. You wouldn't get the Newton constant right. You wouldn't get the strength of the force between the sun and the moon and the earth right. So in order for quantum field theory to produce the correct Einstein action, correct according to experiment, quantum field theory has to be cut off at the Planck scale. So what you see is we have now calculated what LC is, what the cutoff length is. But that means we can calculate C1. Okay? Because I already said these things. Now let's calculate C1. You see, LC, we just calculated, is of the order of 10 to the minus 35 meters. Can't really be more accurate than that because we don't know what this lambda 2 parameter is. It's of order 1, but it could be 100, it could be a tenth, be anything like that. So now we know that the cutoff length has to be 10 to the minus 35 meters. But that means that C1, I'm just digging up a formula that we had a few slides above, C1 is equal to, we had that formula earlier, that C1 is a number of order 1 times 1 over LC to the fourth power. And now we can put this formula together with the knowledge of what LC is. LC is the Planck length. So now we take the Planck length and take it to the fourth power and 1 over it. And this prefactor by the farmer with his cows argument is of order 1. So we can calculate what C1 is, and C1 is up to some decorative prefactors, lambda. It's the cosmological constant. So if we put the numbers in there, we find that the theory predicts that minus 8 pi g C1 is equal to all of this. You work it all out, put in the numbers, it's 10 to the 70 divided by meter squared. This is the worst prediction ever. And this is why everybody's so concerned about this thing. Because Sakharov's argument is rock solid. Nobody has any reason to doubt any of Sakharov's arguments. It's just super strong. It may look vague, but it gives it enormous strength because it don't care exactly how the quantum field theory looks like. It's true for all of them. So it's the worst physical prediction ever because according to experiments, there is a cosmological constant. The Einstein equation has to be supplemented by an extra term, C1, by a cosmological constant in order to describe what's going on. Our universe is, after all, accelerating now, according to the evidence. A Nobel Prize has been given for that already. It is accelerating, and ordinary matter cannot make space-time accelerate. Ordinary matter cannot do it. Only a cosmological constant can do it. You need a negative pressure for that. No ordinary matter has a negative pressure. And you can calculate what that value is, and it's about 10 to the minus 52 over meter squared. This experimental value is to be compared with this prediction, 10 to the 70. It's not 20 orders of magnitude wrong. It's 120 orders. It's 122 orders of magnitude wrong. That's super serious. It used to be thought until a few years ago when this value was first measured, when it was discovered that the universe is accelerating, therefore there is a cosmological constant because that's what cosmological constants do. They make the universe accelerate, as we will see later on. Before that was discovered, it used to be thought, because this is such a tiny value, it used to be thought that it's probably zero. And that was kind of conceptually easy, because people then thought, okay, cosmological constant is predicted to be 10 to the 70 over meter squared, but it actually is zero, so there must be some mechanism, there must be some reason for why the cosmological constant is simply zero. And everybody just said, well, let's just wait. Eventually, one of you guys will figure it out. But there will be some simple reason for why. The C1 term just doesn't gravitate. The trouble is that it is actually finite. And it is so much harder to explain why the cosmological constant is 122 orders of magnitude smaller than predicted, than to come up with an argument that would say it's zero. Right? It could be zero for any number of reasons. For example, supersymmetry would do it. If we had complete supersymmetry in nature, then, as I said, bosons contribute the exact opposite of what fermions contribute to the term C1. So having complete unbroken supersymmetry would explain why, because of a symmetry, that term actually has to vanish. But in the absence of a symmetry, it's very difficult to explain why it is so super fine-tuned around zero. See, if you are a billionaire and you go shopping and gambling and you lose complete control over your finances, and then the next day you check your bank account and you find that you have 1 cent left, you wonder, right? What happened? 1 cent left? Did you just spend everything except for 1 cent? It's a bit like this, except way more orders of magnitude than that. So nobody knows what's going on there. This is one of the biggest mysteries of physics nowadays. All right, this is as far as we got. I can't give you the solution. I hope one of you will figure it out. Okay, see you on Friday.